Imagine an algorithm grading your doctor on exactly how much empathy they showed you during your last virtual visit.
Which, I mean, sounds completely absurd at first, right?
Right. It sounds like a premise from some sci-fi novel.
Yeah.
But according to this massive stack of clinical implementation research, university case studies, and healthcare frameworks that we are diving into today, it's actually happening right now.
Yeah, it is.
So welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we're looking at how artificial intelligence is quietly revolutionizing healthcare education. But the twist here isn't about AI replacing doctors or nurses.
No, not at all.
Right? We're exploring how these really complex systems are actually being used to teach humans to be better, more empathetic clinicians in a totally digital world.
And that is such a critical distinction to make right out of the gate, I think. We're really looking at a transition from a world where telehealth was viewed as, just a corporate video meeting to this highly complex, intelligent learning environment.
Yeah, like it's not just Zoom anymore.
Exactly. The ultimate goal isn't an algorithm that diagnoses you while your doctor plays golf. It's an algorithm working in the background so the clinician can focus entirely on you, the patient.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because to really understand why AI is necessary in a classroom setting, we first have to recognize why teaching virtual care is just such a massive hurdle in the first place.
Right, it's not intuitive.
No, telehealth isn't just booting up a webcam. The clinical research we're looking at defines it as a distinct clinical technique. Like, a provider has to assess, diagnose, educate, monitor, and treat someone without ever sharing a physical space.
And that physical limitation, it requires a complete rewiring of clinical instincts.
Wow, rewiring, how so?
Well, I mean, for centuries, medical education relied on touch, right? On physical presence, palpating an abdomen or listening to lungs with a traditional stethoscope.
Right, the classic doctor visit.
Yeah, and suddenly you have a learner who must make these incredibly complex clinical decisions based entirely on visual cues, verbal communication, and, raw data.
Which is a lot to juggle.
It's a huge cognitive load. They have to manage interprofessional collaboration across different time zones, maintain digital etiquette, and somehow project warmth and empathy through a camera lens.
It's like, okay, telehealth without AI is like trying to fly a modern jet plane manually while simultaneously walking down the aisle to serve drinks to the passengers.
That is a great way to put it.
You simply cannot focus on the person in front of you. The clinician is staring at a screen, but their brain is completely fragmented. They're furiously typing notes, managing multiple software windows, looking up medical histories.
Yeah, it's overwhelming.
So, how do you teach a medical student to build trust and rapport when they are bogged down by all that administrative turbulence?
Well, what's fascinating here is how the technology essentially removes that exact friction.
Yeah.
Because, to build rapport, a clinician really must be fully present.
Right.
So artificial intelligence steps in to augment the practice by handling all the heavy lifting.
The paperwork, basically.
Exactly. The implementation data shows AI actively running real-time speech-to-text transcription, generating clinical documentation drafts, pulling up visit summaries. It even offers personalized patient education recommendations right on the fly.
Okay, so the AI basically acts as an invisible administrative assistant. It's taking the notes so the human can actually look the patient in the eye.
Precisely.
But here is the logical leap we need to explore, because knowing why AI helps in the real world is one thing. How does a student actually learn to use it and trust it before they ever see a real patient?
We can see the mechanism of this by looking at a very specific healthcare simulation that was outlined in the case studies.
Okay, set the scene for us.
Picture a graduate nursing student. They log into a secure portal to conduct a virtual visit with a standardized patient, which is an actor who's highly trained to simulate worsening symptoms of heart failure.
Right, so it's a completely controlled environment.
Exactly. The student starts conducting the interview, trying to assess the heart failure, and the AI is just running quietly in the background. It transcribes the conversation, it drafts the clinical notes, but it goes a step further.
What else does it do?
It actually flags missed assessment questions.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So if the student forgets to ask the patient if their ankles are swelling, which is, a crucial indicator of fluid retention in heart failure, the AI captures that omission for the review later,
So it's essentially grading their clinical thoroughness in real time.
which provides immediate objective performance data. The student doesn't just get a subjective feeling of how they did, they get a concrete readout.
Okay, but here's where it gets really interesting and maybe a little controversial.
I know where you're going with this.
Yeah, because the clinical frameworks detail how the AI also evaluates communication behaviors. It tracks empathy, active listening, and patient-centered language, and I really have to push back here.
Fair enough.
Code does not have feelings. It's just math. How can a machine learning algorithm accurately grade a human being on something as fundamentally emotional as empathy?
If we connect this to the bigger picture, it's really easy to see why having a machine tell a human they aren't being empathetic enough feels incredibly dystopian.
Yeah, it feels super weird.
It does. But we have to look at the mechanism of how the AI is measuring this. It isn't evaluating the soul of the interaction.
Okay, then what is it looking at?
It uses natural language processing to measure the actual mechanics of active listening.
Mechanics? What? Give me an example of how code measures a feeling.
Well, it analyzes the talk-to-listen ratio, for one.
Oh, interesting.
Right. Like, are you dominating the conversation, or are you actually letting the patient speak? It measures the precise pause length, the wait time, after a patient finishes a sentence.
To see if they're just jumping right to the next question.
Exactly. To see if the clinician is rushing or giving the patient space to add more detail. It flags interruptions. It calculates the ratio of open-ended questions to closed yes or no questions.
Wow.
It even tracks specific clinical phrasing. It recognizes the difference between asking, "Does it hurt here?" versus saying, "Tell me more about what that pain feels like."
Okay, that reframes it completely for me. It's capturing the objective markers of empathy that, honestly, a human evaluator might actually miss because they're too focused on whether the student got the heart failure diagnosis right.
Exactly. Humans can't track 50 different data points at once.
Right. But doesn't this risk completely replacing the human instructor if the AI is doing all the grading?
Not at all. And the educational guidelines heavily emphasize this. The instructor absolutely remains the final evaluator.
Okay, so the AI is just a tool.
Right. The AI is simply providing a data-rich dashboard. During the post-simulation debrief, the faculty member uses those AI analytics alongside their own direct observations.
So it's a supplement, not a replacement.
Exactly. It reduces the faculty's workload associated with manually reviewing hours of video footage. And that gives them significantly more time to actually coach the student on those really fine nuances.
And that targeted coaching builds confidence. The learners get this timely, individualized feedback in a completely safe, simulated environment before they ever touch a real patient's digital chart.
Yeah, which is huge for patient safety.
But beyond just making the students better, the research points to it is. Without this tech, you might have to wait 3 weeks for a specific medical translator to be available, or worse, rely on your 12-year-old child to translate complex medical jargon during the visit.
Which happens all the time, sadly.
Right. But AI-driven live translation bridges that gap instantly. Plus, the AI generates a simplified transcript so the patient can review the encounter later.
And that's so important because the retention of medical information post-visit is notoriously low. People are stressed, they forget what was said.
Totally.
So having an immediate, readable transcript promotes a much more equitable experience. It ensures the patient actually understands their care plan once they log off.
We do have to address the friction here, though.
Of course.
Because this is a double-edged sword. You are taking incredibly sensitive, vulnerable medical conversations and feeding them through an algorithmic processor. The practical hurdles are significant.
Oh, they are massive.
You have huge data security requirements. You have algorithmic bias. Like, if an AI is trained primarily on data from one specific demographic, it might misinterpret a regional dialect, right? Or completely misunderstand how a different culture expresses pain.
That's a huge concern in the literature. And transparency is another major hurdle. Patients have a fundamental right to know if an algorithm is analyzing their visit or summarizing their symptoms or suggesting a diagnosis.
And what about the impact on the learner's brain?
The cognitive autopilot issue.
Yes. There is this phenomenon mentioned across all the implementation research about over-reliance on AI recommendations. It sounds like having a GPS in your car, right?
Right.
It's a brilliant tool until you blindly drive into a lake because you put your brain on autopilot and just stopped looking at the actual road.
It happens.
Right. So if the AI is writing the notes, catching the missed questions, and suggesting the treatment plan, how do organizations prevent these medical students from just letting the machine do all the thinking?
This raises an important question, and it is the exact pivot point where the theory of AI crashes into the reality of healthcare.
Okay.
Preventing that cognitive autopilot requires incredibly thoughtful governance, ongoing evaluation, and a firm commitment to human-centered care.
So you can't just buy it and walk away?
No, you cannot just purchase a $1 million software license, hand the nursing students a login, and hope they figure out the ethics on their own.
Which brings us to the actual execution, the blueprint for reality. Because the stakes are literal life and death, you can't just plug this technology into a hospital wall.
You really can't.
And a significant portion of our source material is dedicated to how institutions actually organize and deploy these systems without causing complete chaos.
Right. And before we get into the heavy implementation science, there is a very clean mental model provided by the sources to organize all this complexity.
The four buckets.
Yes.
Yes.
Institutions are encouraged to structure a healthcare AI resource center into four distinct operational buckets.
Okay, let's go through them. Bucket one is AI technologies, and this is the foundational layer.
Right. Machine learning, computer vision, natural language processing. It is simply defining what the tech is and how it functions.
Okay. Then bucket two is AI-enhanced educational techniques. So this is how the tech is actively used to teach.
Exactly. Telehealth simulations, virtual standardized patients, case-based learning platforms.
Got it. Then bucket three is where the real work happens, I think. Implementation and governance.
That's the messy part.
Yeah, this covers the policies, AI literacy, ethical guidelines, accessibility standards, and the rigorous implementation frameworks we're about to talk about.
Right. And finally, bucket four is healthcare use cases, showing how these tools apply specifically to nursing or pharmacy or continuing medical education or specialized surgery.
So it's a very logical progression. You move from understanding the raw code to applying it in a classroom to navigating the legal and ethical rules to finally deploying it in real clinical practice. Let's zoom in on bucket three, the implementation part, because the research introduces the actual science of making this technology stick within an organization. It details two major frameworks, CFIR and EPIs.
Oh, yes, the alphabet soup.
Yeah, to a casual observer, this sounds like academic alphabet soup. Why do we need two whole academic frameworks just to roll out a new software platform?
Because the history of healthcare technology is basically a graveyard of expensive, abandoned software platforms.
Really? Just abandoned?
Oh, yeah. Technology rarely fails in a hospital because the underlying code is bad. It almost always fails because the human ecosystem rejects it.
Okay, that makes a lot of sense.
So CFIR and EPIs are the maps to navigate that complex human ecosystem. Without them, adoption just inevitably collapses.
So let's break down that map. Let's start with CFIR, the Consolidated Framework for Implementation Research.
That's a mouthful.
It is. But basically, it helps organizations identify factors that influence success across five interconnected domains. It is essentially the what of implementation.
Let's look at those five domains practically so it's not so abstract. The first is innovation characteristics.
Okay, meaning what?
Meaning before a hospital buys an AI platform, they have to evaluate if it actually provides a clear, measurable advantage over their current system. Like, is it actually usable? What is the real clinical evidence supporting it?
Right. Does it actually fix a problem?
Exactly.
The second domain is the outer setting, and these are the external pressures completely outside of the hospital or university's direct control. Give me an example of an outer setting forcing a hospital's hand.
Accreditation requirements are a perfect example of this.
Oh, like mandates.
Right. If a state medical board or a national nursing accreditor suddenly mandates that all graduates must demonstrate virtual care competencies to get their license well, that external pressure completely dictates how fast and how seriously an institution has to adopt this technology.
They don't have a choice anymore.
Exactly. Their hands are tied.
That makes perfect sense. Then we move inside. Domain three is the inner setting. This is organizational readiness. Do you actually have the IT infrastructure to support massive data processing? And honestly, more importantly, is there a culture of psychological safety?
And psychological safety is perhaps the biggest failure point of all.
Really? More than the tech itself?
Absolutely. Think about it. If a hospital administration buys a complex AI system, but the nursing faculty is already experiencing severe burnout, and there's a culture of penalizing mistakes, nobody's going to use the new tool.
Because they're scared of messing up.
Exactly. They will actively avoid it.
Yeah.
So the inner setting evaluates if leadership support is genuine or if it's just lip service.
Wow. Okay. Domain four focuses on individuals, the actual human beings logging into the system, the faculty, the learners, the IT professionals.
Right. Because success depends heavily on their baseline AI literacy and their general willingness to embrace change management.
And finally, domain five is the implementation process itself. So engaging the right stakeholders, designing pilot tests, and committing to quality improvement.
Right. So CFIR brilliantly identifies all the complex cultural, technical, and human variables you have to consider. It tells you exactly what might break.
But it doesn't tell you how to roll it out.
No. CFIR alone doesn't tell you exactly when to take action. That is where the second framework, EPIS, becomes so essential.
Okay. EPIS. Exploration, preparation, implementation, sustainment. So if CFIR is the ingredients list telling me what's culturally broken or ready in my hospital, EPIS is the actual recipe and timeline for fixing it and rolling out the tech on a Monday morning.
Precisely. It is a highly practical, chronological roadmap. So phase one is exploration.
Which means?
This isn't just window shopping for software. You are conducting deep needs assessments. For example, a medical school faculty might analyze their data and realize their students are graduating with incredibly high diagnostic skills, but terrible bedside manner in virtual visits.
So they identified a very specific gap to fill.
Right. Then phase two is preparation.
Yep.
Building the actual infrastructure.
Right. So you select the AI platform, you design the specific heart failure simulation scenarios we talked about earlier, you train the faculty on how to actually read those NLP empathy dashboards, and you establish all the privacy policies.
And the data strongly suggests this is where you run a quiet, very controlled pilot test.
To catch the bugs.
Exactly. To catch catastrophic workflow issues before they ever affect real patients.
Then you hit phase three. Implementation, the innovation finally goes live.
Right. You run the simulations with a broader group of learners. You collect their feedback, monitor how the technology behaves under stress, and refine the workflows.
The human faculty members conduct the assessments, and the AI provides the supplemental analytics.
Exactly.
And then phase four is sustainment. And based on the research, I would argue this is where the entire ecosystem either thrives or just completely dies.
It is definitely the most critical and unfortunately the most often neglected phase.
Why neglect?
Because people think implementation is a one-time event, like a ribbon-cutting ceremony. But long-term success requires continuous monitoring.
Let's talk about the friction there. What happens if an institution just skips sustainment entirely? They launch it and forget it.
Then you experience what data scientists call data drift or concept drift.
Which means?
Medical guidelines change constantly, right? The standard of care for heart failure in 2026 might be totally different by 2028.
Oh, I see.
So if nobody is continually monitoring and updating the AI in the sustainment phase, the algorithm will just continue grading students based on outdated medicine.
You end up actively teaching bad practices.
Exactly. Plus, you have to continuously audit for emerging algorithmic biases and ensure your accessibility features still meet current legal standards.
So what does this all mean when we put the pieces together? Because this is a lot of theory. Let's run a quick simulation of this entire process for you listening. A real-world application of CFIR and EPIS working in tandem.
Sure. We can use a scenario adapted directly from the implementation models in our sources. Let's say a College of Nursing decides to introduce AI-supported telehealth simulations for their graduate nurse practitioner cohort.
Okay. So applying CFIR first to map out the ecosystem. The college assesses their inner setting. They realize their faculty needs advanced training on interpreting those AI empathy scores. So they secure funding from the dean, which locks in that crucial leadership support.
Right. And then they evaluate the outer setting, ensuring this new tech perfectly aligns with national telehealth billing codes and state requirements.
Okay, map is drawn. Then they activate the EPIS timeline.
Yes. During exploration, they confirm the specific communication gaps their students actually have.
In preparation, they design a small pilot program with just, say, 20 students.
Then in implementation, they run that pilot. They gather feedback and maybe realize the AI is occasionally misunderstanding a specific regional dialect of the standardized patient.
So they recalibrate the software.
Exactly. Finally, in sustainment, they expand the program to all 200 students in the college.
And they set up a quarterly review board to audit the AI's performance, ensuring it remains highly accurate, ethical, and aligned with the absolute latest clinical guidelines.
That's the full picture right there.
The result is an incredibly deliberate, evidence-informed adoption process. Whether you are a patient waiting in a virtual waiting room, or a medical student trying to navigate an interface, or even a hospital administrator signing the checks, this phased, deliberate approach is the only thing standing between a chaotic technology disaster and a system that actually elevates the standard of care.
And, you know, the overarching theme across all this research is profoundly optimistic, I think.
Really? despite all the hurdles.
Yes, because the future of healthcare education is not about building machines to replace the human element of medicine. It's about rigorously equipping clinicians to use technology to deliver safer, more nuanced, and much more equitable care to every single patient.
It has been a truly fascinating journey through this ecosystem today. We started by redefining telehealth, entirely recognizing that it's a complex clinical skill demanding a totally new set of competencies.
Not just a video call.
Right. And we looked under the hood of a virtual classroom to see how code uses natural language processing to objectively measure the mechanics of human empathy.
Which is still wild to think about.
It really is. And finally, we mapped out the intense structured science of CFIR and EPDIS that institutions must follow to keep these tools from just completely going off the rails.
It forces you to realize that behind every seamless 5-minute digital interaction you have with a doctor, there's this massive, invisible mountain of preparation, educational theory, and rigorous scientific methodology.
It definitely changes how I view my webcam, that's for sure.
Huh.
And it leaves me with one final thought to mull over.
What's that?
Well, if an artificial intelligence system can accurately assess, track, and coach a medical student's empathy in a simulated classroom today, how long until that exact same AI is running quietly in the background of your actual virtual doctor's visit, subtly coaching your physician in real time on how to communicate with you better?
Wow.
And perhaps the more important question for you listening, would you actually want to know it's there?
That is a very complex question we will all be forced to answer sooner rather than later.
Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive. Keep questioning, keep exploring, and we'll catch you next time.